Hi, welcome to Writers After Dark. I'm Summer Brooks, and as always, good stories start with the writer, since wherever there's a story, someone's either making it up or writing it down. And my guest today is one of the most gifted, talented, and prolific writers I've ever had the pleasure of meeting, Kevin J. Anderson, who has, I can't actually think of a genre that you haven't written in.
Well, not under my own name, probably not, but let's just stick to the ones that people maybe know me from, the science fiction and fantasy and horror and mysteries and media tie-ins, and I do a lot of nonfiction as well, and you know, I love telling stories. I love playing with my imaginary friends and then hurting them and doing nasty things to them, and all for the entertainment of the reader.
Excellent. Now, most people know you from the 250 Dune novels, the 872 Star Wars novels.
Now you're just pulling statistics out of nowhere.
It just sounds like it, because like every time you walk by a bookshelf or you browse Amazon, it's like, oh, Kevin's got 18 Dune novels and 12 Star Wars novels. Cool.
Well, you're getting closer on that one. We've done a, in fact, in October is the 20th anniversary of Dune House Atreides, which was the first Dune novel that Brian Herbert and I wrote together.
20 years.
That's 20 years, and we've done 14 Dune novels in the 20 years, so it's not that excessive. But we've also, or I've also done a whole bunch of Star Wars books with that was mainly back in the 90s and the 2000s, and I think I did a total of 54 projects for Lucasfilm, if you count all the comic books and the pop-up books and the anthologies and everything that I did. But I'm a professional science fiction fan. I mean, I spend all kinds of time every year being a guest at comic cons and science fiction conventions, and I fit right in because I grew up being a fanboy, and I watched Space 1999 and Lost in Space and Star Trek and The Twilight Zone, and that's what formed my life, and I read voraciously, and I always wanted to be a writer. And so I wrote a bunch of my own novels. On the basis of those, Lucasfilm noticed my writing, and they asked me to do Star Wars books for them, and I wrote a whole bunch of Star Wars books and really got into that. And that's what trained me to basically play with other people's toys in their sandbox. And so I then got asked to write X-Files books and Batman and Superman and all kinds of other things. And kind of the big turning point in my life was when Brian Herbert and I got together to try to finish up the big Dune Chronicles that his father had written. And Frank Herbert had passed away in, I should know this, 1984, 85, something like that. And then we finished that story and did a bunch of prequels based on a bunch of notes that he left behind. And now we're involved with this huge feature film that Legendary and Warner Brothers is producing, an adaptation of Frank Herbert's Dune.
Mm-hmm.
And they've just announced a spin-off streaming TV series called Dune: The Sisterhood, which is partly based on some of our stuff. And we've got, well, all kinds of graphic novels and games, and I'm working on, you know, we could fill the whole half hour if I just talk about what I'm working on, because I just, I guess I'm a type A person, and I want to write all the time and edit all the time and get these stories out of my head, because that's the fastest way that I can read them, is if I write them down. And I've got a lot of original books, and one of the ones we'll be talking about, I think, is a brand new fantasy series that I just launched about a month ago called Spine of the Dragon. So that's my own original stuff, kind of a Game of Thrones, huge epic fantasy with lots of point of view characters and the end of the world and dragons and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know what else to say other than that I just love writing all the time, and these characters just crowd into my imagination and the stories and the things that they do. And like all day long, it's just quickly trying to write them down and to develop my books. And I interact a lot with my fans, and because I'm a fan myself, and that's what I like to convey.
And your fans of all your different works have always, I guess, chomped at the bit to get whatever you've written next. And when I saw this come out, I'm like, wait, when was the last time he wrote a fantasy? And I honestly racked my brains, couldn't think of a fantasy you had written in recent years, like meaning less than 20 years.
No, I had, in fact, I considered some of my best work. I had this huge, like, Sailing Ships and Sea Monsters trilogy called Terra Incognita that came out from Warner and Orbit. It was sort of a fantasy version of the Crusades and the Age of Exploration. And that was The Edge of the World and The Map of All Things and The Key to Creation. Those three books came out. And in fact, we even had we produced two progressive rock CDs with music based on those books. But I like those. But at the time, the publisher went, yes, well, we'll indulge Kevin because he writes science fiction. And if he wants to put magic in it, okay. But I have never really made that huge distinction that I only write science fiction or I only write fantasy, because what I write, in my mind at least, are good stories. And I do all the world building, and I build the magic system just the same way that I build, like, the space travel system or the Galactic Empire. And I just tell the story that interests me most. And I've always read piles and piles of fantasy. In fact, when I was just in high school, that was the big, huge boom after Terry Brooks released The Sword of Shannara. And then everybody wrote their quest fantasy trilogy, and I was the 12-year-old in the bookstore grabbing every single one, where you just had to read the cast of characters walking across the map and having adventures until they kill the big bad guy at the end of book three. And that happened maybe a few too many times for me. So Spine of the Dragon is not like that. And yes, there are maps at the beginning, but it is more. I was really more influenced in recent years by the Game of Thrones type of books, these huge stories that aren't all about wizards waving their staffs and calling down rainbow lightning bolts and stuff. But this is more of a political, social, historical thing that does have magic and it does have legends. It's one of those where if you just give a plot summary, then you just have to sit back and listen for 10 minutes because there's so much stuff going on. But I think the best way to pitch it is that this is Kevin J. Anderson's big new epic fantasy, and if you like the other stuff, you'll like this stuff.
Well, the series is called Wake the Dragon. Spine of the Dragon is the first book in the series. The story, the feel of it, from the politics and warring kingdoms kind of thing, I haven't finished the book yet, so bear with me. But the
don't all die at the end. But
the setup to me felt a lot like the political intrigues going on in Melanie Ron's Dragon Prince series, where everybody's fighting each other, and then this invading force that was thought to be legend comes by, and everybody goes, oh shit, really?
Well, except in mine, the big legendary force comes back to destroy the world, and then the humans go, now we'll fight each other instead. So that's maybe my cynical perception of humanity, that we always have this great habit of fighting the wrong bad guys and focusing on scapegoats and things. But it's a big story, and I finished writing book two, and I'm doing my second edit on it right now. But my editor really wants me to get it under 700 pages long, so I'm having to work very hard on that. But now I'm on this quandary of, after these two big fat books where I keep throwing more and more and more stuff at the fan, now I'm looking at, well, it's supposed to be a trilogy, and I'm supposed to wrap everything up, and oh boy, how am I going to do that in just one more book? But we'll see.
So what you're saying is you're going to have to send your editor a note going, okay, I can get book two in under 700, but you got to give me 850 for book three.
Or give me four books. I mean, one or the other. I mean, that's now, one of the things that I can say, though, and my fans will know this if they've been reading my stuff, is that I am absolutely reliable, so that when they start reading my Saga of Seven Sons and each book ends on a cliffhanger, well, they know that I'm going to come out with the next book next year, period. It's going to be out on time, I'm not late. I'm quite reliable. So please don't say that you're going to read Spine of the Dragon after the entire series is done, because that kind of attitude really hurts the author. Because then, if nobody buys book one and they all wait for book three, then by the time book three comes out, then the publisher says we don't even want to publish it because nobody bought one book one. So it's a kind of a conundrum for readers. And remember, I'm a fan and I'm a reader, and I get disappointed when you read the first two books in the series and then 12 years go by and you haven't read the next one yet because it's still in process. But trust me, I published 165 books. I will come out with the next ones on time. So go and check Spine of the Dragon out, and while I edit book two, it's already written.
So in Spine of the Dragon, what was the story you wanted to tell that led to Spine of the Dragon being created?
Well, I actually wanted to turn to fantasy because I had written The Saga of Seven Sons and then a sequel trilogy, The Saga of Shadows, and then I had written all these Dune books with Brian. And you're right. I mean, I did write the Terra Incognita fantasy trilogy. I think it was in the mid-2000s. And I loved it, but I spent so much time with science fiction. But I wanted to tell a big epic fantasy story where nobody quite knew what was true, that there are legends about this dragon beneath the world, and if somebody wakes him up, then it's the end times, the end of the world. And you got this ancient race that wants to wake up the dragon because they feel that then their god will come back and reform the world in a perfect way, kind of like Noah and the Ark. But of course, the humans who are going to be wiped out when that happens don't really want that to happen, so they want to stop the dragon from being awakened, if the dragon even exists. I mean, there's earthquakes and there's volcanoes, and is that the dragon stirring beneath the world, or is it like we normally know normal geological events? And then there are dragons that show up after a long time, and then there are humans who basically have a crusade against two different continents, are fighting each other, and somebody wants an alliance so that they can fight the real enemy, and then the other humans kind of would rather pick on each other instead of forming peace. and there are monsters and dragons, and one of the coolest things that I've got in there, that this is manifesting kind of religion and magic, that these settlers are in one of the continents. The land itself is kind of pristine and pure, and it's like got lots of magic in it. So all these people who believe that there's like a god that protects the waterfall, or a god that protects this area, they believe in this thing, and there's enough magic in the world that their belief in it makes the thing real. And the more they see it, the more they believe in it, so the more they make their, it's called a godling, the more they make it stronger. And I kind of based it on the creatures of the id from Forbidden Planet, like the things in your subconscious that become manifest and tangible and really dangerous. If you believe in this nasty, vengeful godling, well, it manifests as a pretty nasty, nasty thing. And that's one of my favorite creations in this whole series. So how this whole continent of people, it's this spiral that they've made up their godlings, and then they see that they're real, so they believe more in them, which makes them more powerful, and they get kind of out of control. So I'm doing book two now when everything's out of control, and it's lots more fun with explosions and you know, as a writer, I have an unlimited special effects budget, so I can just put this $900 million movie in my mind and throw all kinds of dragons and monsters and everybody should know that I'm a big fan since I was a little kid of you know, Godzilla and Rodan and King Kong and all the giant guys wearing monster suit movies. So I get to write them in my book and put them into fantasy.
So fantasy. What you're saying is some of the battles that you've created are Battle of the Bastards. Others are Battlestar Galactica fighting off the one Cylon base star when, you know, it dropped through the atmosphere, and then all that other stuff. So you've got a little bit of everything creating a huge, huge mess, but looking really cool.
You're speaking my language. Yes. And I like having a big cast of characters. I know there are some writers who prefer to just have one or two main characters. And I like to see the world and the war and the history, that's really the main character. I was talking with Brandon Sanderson once, and he said, "Well, who's the main character in your series?" And I stopped and I thought, and I went, "The story is the main character." Like that, and by having all these different points of view, I get to basically have this bird's eye view of everything that's going on, and the reader can experience the totality of like this war to bring about the end of the world. And I like having that kind of freedom. I have written some stuff with like first person narrator, so it's only one character. I have a whole humorous series with Dan Shamble, Zombie PI. So that's sort of like the Naked Gun with zombies. And that's all first person. So I write that inside the main character's head, which it lets you be more personal. But the problem with that is you can only tell the story with what that one character sees through his eyes. And so if you've got something like the bad guy set planting a bomb somewhere, you can't have a scene of the bad guy planting a bomb, because unless my character sees that with his own eyes, I can't write it in the book. So that has constraints to it, but I guess when you're writing like dorky slapstick comedy, that it gets a little bit more fun to be first person. But so yes, that's another genre, humorous zombie mysteries that I write, and giant epic fantasies. And I have a brand new mainstream thriller coming out called Kill Zone that I wrote with Doug Beeson, whom I've collaborated with many times over the years. And Doug is a retired colonel from the U.S. Air Force. He's got a PhD physicist. He was the director of Air Force Space Command, and he was in the president's science office. So we write like real Tom Clancy kind of stuff when we work together. And Kill Zone is about a bunch of people trapped inside a nuclear waste storage facility, and they're trying to get out, but all the security systems are trying to stop them, as well as they're trying to stop each other, and it's kind of like the Poseidon Adventure inside a big mountain nuclear waste storage facility. So that's cutting edge and high tech, and no dragons whatsoever, but I can write it. It's got radiation and nuclear fuel rod, so I guess that's as scary as a dragon is.
Yeah, so what you're saying is you've written a modern-day thriller set in a dangerous situation where if our heroes fail, they become the stars of the next Resident Evil movie?
Yes. There we go. It's an origin story. Think of it that way.
That's...
So, like I said, I have very wide tastes, and I read a lot, and I watch tons of movies and TV shows, and I'm not I like to say, like, read Silence of the Lambs and take that horrible serial killer stuff that I learn and plop it into like a fantasy novel, because you're not used to seeing edgy Thomas Harris, Dean Koontz kind of serial killer stuff in an epic fantasy. So I'm using skills from other genres that I write. And in fact, I like reading these big historical novels. I love Shogun and Lonesome Dove and Ken Follett's Pillars of the Earth. And that's kind of the model that I use to write these huge epic fantasies or epic science fiction, because those huge historical epics like Shogun are the kind of stories that I like to tell. And it doesn't matter to me if it's in historical ancient Japan or on the planet Malgon in the Galactic Empire somewhere, that it's all a big story and interesting characters. And if you do your description and world building well enough, then it becomes real for the reader.
Okay, you need to get out of my dreamscape, because I just started thinking about Shogun this week, wondering if it was available on DVD yet, because I think that was one that had some rights issues or something and wasn't on home video, the TV series. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I mean, I saw it when it was on TV, and I don't think I ever had the 28 hours free to watch it all over again.
But it just popped into my head earlier this week, going, huh, I wonder if that's on home video or not. I never looked, but now I have to, because you mentioned it. But it sounds like you have more fun building a world with issues and then seeing what the people who are already there do to deal with the stuff you throw at them.
Right. In fact, I think that I like to go out and hike all by myself in the mountains. I do a lot of public appearances, and I'm a pretty gregarious guy, but I really do like to be alone. And there are times when I'm setting up a giant fantasy world where I think, you know what, forget all the monsters. The people are really the problem, because they're the ones that screw something up, or they don't do what they're supposed to do, or they stab each other in the back. And what I learned from my creative writing class way, way, way back when I was in college, and you don't often learn a lot from a creative writing class, at least the ones that I took, but I had a professor that just kind of looked squarely at us and said, you guys do know that no bad guy ever thinks he's the bad guy, right? And that mm-hmm. really kind of framed me, because I went, oh, well, you don't have this villain going, ha, 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 I'm going to be more evil today than I was yesterday. They all are, I mean, especially when I was doing Terra Incognita books, which really is like the Crusades. There's effectively Christian Europe and effectively Europe, Middle East, and it's in a fantasy world. But there's no good guys or bad guys, because when you're in their head, they think the other guy's the bad guy. And that's how I like to put all of my characters in these stories. Like in Spine of the Dragon, there's two continents at war, and they hate each other, but I have characters on both sides, and they don't think that the other side is the good guy. And so when you get well enough into somebody's head and understand their beliefs and their driving, and the second book is called Venge War, it's really all about how revenge can get out of control. That it's, you know, if you have like little kids, she hit me back. You know, it's like I hit you, and then you hit me back, and then I have to hit you because you hit me back, and then it just goes around and around in a circle, and it gets worse and worse and worse. And when you add magic and dragons into that same situation, then it just becomes a $900 million special effects magic and monster movie.
So for you, when you were creating the world of Spine of the Dragon and the characters therein, what was the one thing, or maybe two things, that surprised you, excited you the most, when you're like, oh, really? Cool.
Well, when I started developing these godlings, the super powerful entities that people create just by believing in them, I thought that was a really interesting take on, there's a demon living in the temple, like in your Dungeons and Dragons fantasy. But what if this is something that humans themselves create, because they've got the power of imagination, and if there's magic intrinsic in the world, and they imagine something nasty enough that they can make real. I think there was like a Twilight Zone episode like that. Well, maybe it was just the kid going to wish you out into the cornfield. That if you have an imagination that's powerful enough, that could be wonderful at first, and then what happens when you have nightmares? And then it gets worse and worse. And it just made things happen really cool in the story building that I was coming up with. And then you start getting good priests who are making their godlings benevolent, and then you have these vengeful ones that want to have horrible, powerful monsters that can tear ships and villages apart just to get their revenge. And I just, some of those, the writing, some of that, I mean, there's, I guess, chapter two of Spine of the Dragon when we unleash one of these things. It's just like, it's the creatures of the id, and how much I loved that Forbidden Planet movie when I was a kid. And it was so scary because you really didn't see much of it. You just little flickers of half-formed shapes, because these were the monsters that the super alien race, the Krell, created out of their own imaginations. And so there I'm revealing what I stole the whole idea from for this book. But I think I did something a little original with it.
What sort of fan reaction have you had? Because I've seen a lot of people really are getting into the intrigue, and it is a book that forces you to continue to turn the next page. So starting it at 10 o'clock at night is not a good idea.
Well, I've gotten some really good response on this one, and remember, so much of my fan base comes to me directly from either the Dune stuff or Star Wars stuff or Batman or Superman or X-Files. And so they already come with like a pre-established fan base. And sometimes you have to nudge them a little bit to read outside their comfort zone. That, well, no, I just read Star Wars books every month. Well, that's great too, because I've written a lot of Star Wars books. But sometimes they trying to get them to pick up Spine of the Dragon, and I, a lot of them have, and I'm getting this great feedback from it. And I even had this one former troll, the guy who generally didn't like my stuff and trashes it, and he writes and says, well, I didn't want to like this book, and I don't normally like what Kevin Anderson writes, but damn it, I couldn't stop turning the pages, and I read it all the way through. And so I suppose that's a pretty good compliment on that one. So, but like I said, it does end on a pretty hefty cliffhanger, because it's just the first part of a series, and I have written the second one already. It's due to be turned in the end of December, and so you won't have too long to wait. It's in the works. You can count on me.
That's a good thing, because the worrying about the next book in the series is a worry we can put aside now. So awesome news. Now, for the cliff, for the thriller that you have written, when is that coming out, or is that already out?
It's I think it's August 26th. It's real soon now, just the next week or two. It's Tor Books is releasing it, or Forge Books is their mainstream thriller line. It'll be in hardcover. It's by me and Doug Beeson, called Killzone. And like I said, it's completely different from Sign of the Dragon, because it's got politics and corrupt senators and nuclear waste storage vaults and terrorists that want to steal nuclear waste and defense systems that don't work quite the way they were designed to work, because it's the Army and things don't always work the way they're supposed to. I have worked for the military for many, many years, and I've written many procedures for them. So that's just a fun one, and it's a standalone. It's not book one of the 12-volume Escape from the Nuclear Waste Facility series. It's done. Doug and I have written, we did Ignition, which was sort of like Die Hard at the Kennedy Space Center, and we did Ill Wind, which was a Fall of Civilization book, and we did some high-tech mysteries, Virtual Destruction and Fallout and Lethal Exposure, and then we did like a one called The Trinity Paradox, which was time travel. A nuclear protester tries to sabotage the Manhattan Project back in World War II. So we've done, I should know this, like a dozen books together and a bunch of short stories. And man, I've known Doug since 1991 or something like that. So it's been a long time that we wrote a book together, and this was one that we kind of got fired up about and we wanted to do it. Gives us an excuse to have beer and pizza and brainstorm together. So.
Hey, that's a goal. That's a goal.
Works now, for me.
Now, are you working on anything else that you can talk about, since like this new thriller is coming out, and you said you've already finished book two of Wake the Dragon?
Well, finished as in wrote. I've written it, so I'm on my second edit, and it'll probably go through three or four edits. And if you got a 700-page book, it takes a while
that
to
takes
edit.
A while.
Edit the whole manuscript and some short stories, and I became a professor. I'm running an entire graduate program so that people can get a Master of Arts degree in publishing, and so classes on that start in 10 days, and I'm spending a lot of what should be my writing time writing online classes that I have to be uploading, and then I have to get familiar with the whole, it's called Blackboard, it's an online like a curriculum thing for students to log into. So that's distracting me a bit right now. And I've got several other books on the back burner or middle burner. I wrote two wonderful steampunk fantasy novels with Neil Peart, the drummer from Rush. And
he wrote
Clockwork Angels and Clockwork Lives, which are two of my favorite books of all time, and that I've written. And we've got a third one of those that we've got a whole bunch of notes for, and it just, I don't have the time or the imaginary elbow room to get enough of that done. But that's kind of, you know, like the plant in Little Shop of Horrors that yells, feed me, feed me. Well, I've got these book ideas that go, write me. And I just need to find more time to do it. And I travel a lot. I've already done probably 10 or 12 trips this year. And Dragon Con's coming right up, and then Salt Lake Comic Con, and then I've got two workshops in Las Vegas I'm going to. We've been invited to China. We've been invited to Ukraine. So, and how do you say no to stuff like that? You want to go, and I'm just glad that I can work on the airplane on my laptop because I seem to always be in an airport. So that's a couple of things that are going on. I've written some new short stories, and I run my own publishing house, so we're releasing other people's books as well as my own books. And in fact, as of it was literally this morning, I got the letter. I got the rights back to some of my favorite old books, Captain Nemo and The Martian War. So I have those books that I'll be republishing through my own imprint so that we can bring them back out. And so it's never a dull moment, Summer. Even I can't keep track of what I'm doing. It's more of a reactive, oh, yeah, that one's due tomorrow, so I better work on it. And I just keep rolling along and having a great time at it and meeting a lot of fans, and they seem to have a good time reading it. So that's what makes it all worthwhile.
Cool. Can you talk for a couple minutes about WordFire Press?
Well, WordFire Press is, I think we started it in earnest around 2010, which was when the whole like independent publishing movement really started taking off. So I kind of by dumb luck fell into it. I was a perfect candidate. This is Amazon came out with the Kindle, and a lot of the other publishers started going out of business. I was a writer with a lot of books in my backlist. And once, in the old days, when you were a writer and your book got published, it came out, and a couple years later it went out of print and nobody wanted to touch it again. Well, I had a whole bunch of books like that that I had the rights to, and over the years I had built up quite a large fan base of people who wanted to read the Kevin Anderson books that they had not read yet, but they weren't available unless you could snag a copy in a used bookstore. And so with the technology available, we just took all of my old books and started putting them up as ebooks, and people gobbled them up. And then I had a lot of other author friends who were in the same boat, and they didn't want to form their own publishing company or figure out how to do it. They just wanted their books available again. So I had a lot of people, Brian Herbert, and he gave me a bunch of the backlist of Frank Herbert's non-Dune books, which were all out of print. Jody Lynn Nye, Robert Asprin, Mike Resnick, Alan Dean Foster. A lot of our books are just from friends of mine that we've reissued them. And it sort of mushroomed from there. And we do everything in ebooks and trade paperback, and most of them in hardcover now. We're doing a lot of them in audiobooks, and that's kind of turned into a full-time job too, with a whole bunch of extra employees helping it out. And that, of course, is what got me in a position to be teaching this graduate degree in publishing. And so WordFire Press is it takes up a lot of my time, but I've got all of my books back in print now, which makes me as an author feel all nice and warm and fuzzy. So that's worth it. You do all the work writing your book, you want to be able to have it available for people to read it if they want to.
Awesome. So where is the best place for new fans who are only just jumping on the Kevin J. Anderson train to start following you? Because you have, there's like three websites, and I don't know how deep you are in the social media, but...
Well, I'm like up to my eyeballs in social media. Because Facebook is just so jerky that they won't let you have more than 5,000 people. So I had a page, a personal page that filled up with 5,000 friends. And then I had to form a fan page because you had to put after 5,000 onto some other place. And then it turned out that I needed a fan group instead of a fan page. I just have one of all of them that I put in there, and we've got 12,500 followers on Twitter, and I've got a newsletter, and so why do I ever get any writing done? That's kind of a mystery sometimes. But these days, it is all the more important that an author can stay in touch with his fans, that you have to interact with your own readers, because right now, every single person listening to this podcast has got like a million books that they could choose, and I want them to choose my book. So you have to interact with them, and and try to engage them and make them want to read Spine of the Dragon or Killzone or the Dan Shamble Zombie PI books or whatever. So I've got, you know, I don't do my blog very much anymore. That seems to take too much time, and I just do lots of Facebook posts. Just look for my name, Kevin J. Anderson. There's the official Kevin J. Anderson page, is an easy place to keep in touch with things. But like you said at the beginning, Summer, I've written in so many different genres that if you like steampunk, then try Clockwork Angels. If you like epic fantasy, then try Spine of the Dragon. If you like humorous zombies, then try the Dan Shamble Zombie PI. If you like thrillers, try Killzone. And I just want no excuses. You can't say that there's nothing there that you're interested in. I try to write one of everything.
Well, we will have links to as many of those as I can collect. Kevin, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Summer. It's good to talk to you again. It's been a long time. We'll have to do it again.
I am planning to do it when the next book comes out, the sequel to Spine of the Dragon. How's that?
Okay, that sounds great. That'll be in a year or so. So, and I will get it done on time, I promise.
Awesome. It's always fun to chat with Kevin just because of how many stories he's written. He's forgotten more about storytelling than most of the rest of us will ever be able to experience, unless we live to be 200 years old or so. But Spine of the Dragon is a fun read. Can't wait for the sequel. And I'm hoping to get a chance to read Killzone as well. Techno thrillers are an interesting genre. Sometimes they're done well, sometimes they're just okay, but this is a thriller co-written by Kevin, so my expectations are high. Oh, but if you have any questions or comments on this interview or any other ones we've done, please feel free to call. The number is 602-635-6976. Or you can shoot me an email, summer@writersafterdark.com. Got a few books here to give away. Anthologies, short story anthologies, a couple of arcs of books that are already out now. But if you're interested in that, let me know. I'm trying to figure out what kind of books people enjoy or would enjoy getting in a contest or giveaway. I may do a Twitter poll on that just to make sure I get enough feedback on that. You can listen to Writers After Dark on Apple Podcasts, on Stitcher, on Google Play, and Player FM. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Google Play, please leave us a review. Let other folks know that you are enjoying the show and they should check it out for themselves. More reviews means a higher profile, that more people get to see the show. So, if you can, thank you in advance. You can follow us on Twitter at Write After Dark. That's WRITE After Dark. And of course, there's the website, writersafterdark.com, where you can actually weigh in with your own assessment of the book and graphic novel and audiobook reviews that we've done here. And of course, leave comments on any of the episodes of this show. I'd like to thank everyone who is supporting the show here and at Slice of Sci-Fi and the Archives for Babylon podcast and a handful of other shows. Your support goes to keep these projects online so that other people can find them and enjoy them. It never ceases to amaze me how many people are coming to the Babylon podcast, are discovering Babylon podcast. And we ended that show in 2012 after 7 years of talking about a TV show that was only on the air for five. We did some deep, deep geeky dives on that show, its spinoffs, its movies, its novels, its comic books, And even its unproduced scripts. So there's a reason to keep those shows online. There's a reason to keep doing this show and Slice of Sci-Fi. And your support, your donations, do help keep all of this online. So thank you in advance to those of you who are considering adding your support. And thank you so, so much for those of you who currently are. If you want to add your support, the place to go is patreon.com/sliceofscifi. Or if you only want to donate now and then, the link to use is paypal.me/scifisummer. I'd like to also throw a shout out to Shadon and Sybin Quest for providing the theme music here for this show. We have links to where you can find them if you're interested in listening to other compositions that they have created over the years. But that'll do it for this episode. Thank you for listening. See you next time. And remember, keep looking for your own stories.